This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
Welcome to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and with me in the studio is Carey Jr. II. He is the show's producer.
Good day, Stephen.
Hey, Carey, how are you?
I'm good. I didn't have coffee, but I don't know. I woke up on the right side of the bed this morning.
Oh, that's good. That's maybe surprising given the chaos that's going on weather-wise around here.
Right.
These crazy storms last night really disrupted an awful lot of people. I just was watching on social media the destruction in some parts of Metro Detroit.
And there were some brownouts, too, I've heard. Some folks or friends I know who were talking about
the
power.
We better get used to it, and we better start working on infrastructure that will be able to withstand these kind of storms, because they're happening more frequently. Speaking of disruptions, that's what we want to talk about today on the show. A different kind of disruption, a disruption to democracy, I guess, if you will. We talk a lot about the idea of voter access and making sure that everyone has the same chance to participate in our democracy. But usually when we're talking about that, we're talking about things that are not direct barriers to voting. We're talking about things like voter eligibility, voter registration, keeping the rolls intact so that people, when they show up, are actually registered and can cast a vote. But today we want to talk about actual barriers to people voting, more literal barriers, this idea of access, physical access to voting places, which you would not think was a big issue, but apparently here in Southeast Michigan, it really is.
Yeah, it reminds me of a conversation we had back in April about a former class action lawsuit about the government buildings in this state and whether or not they are ADA compliant. There was a claim that they weren't. And in this conversation, we're talking about disability access and internet connectivity and how that impacts folks' ability to vote at polling locations, disabled people's ability to vote at polling locations, and just folks' general opportunity and access to internet and more information. So I'm interested in getting into this. I mean, some information that we do have from Detroit Disability Power, which is an advocacy organization for disabled people, audited. They audited 261 polling locations across 15 jurisdictions throughout the region in Southeast Michigan. And based off of their criteria, they found that a large percentage, around 84% of those polling locations, weren't accessible for disabled people. So that's one thing. On top of that, internet connectivity in Detroit, a significant percentage of households in the city don't have access to broadband internet. So both of those issues we want to tackle today.
Yeah, I mean, that number is pretty astonishing, 84%. And if you think about the indignity of showing up to vote, having registered to vote, going out on election day and being physically barred, really, from exercising your part in our democracy. I mean, it's pretty outrageous. And and it is, again, something that we don't talk an awful lot about, I think, partially because for most of us, this isn't an issue. It's an issue for a certain percentage of the population, and they don't get the attention that they should.
And yeah, and what I was alluding to before about it being an extension of a conversation we had in April, right? Like, this all goes towards democratic participation. In that conversation that we had previously about government buildings, is there folks who are disabled's ability to listen to their government officials and be able to weigh in on what's going on in the city. In this case, it's about being able to actually participate in elections. So I think this is definitely an important conversation that we've got two pretty interesting guests that we're going to have on. Do you want me to do the honor, Stephen?
Sure. Absolutely.
All right. So we'll be joined by Dessa Cosma. She is the executive director of Detroit Disability Power, the organization that audited the polling locations. She will be talking about disability access. And then we'll be joined by Christopher Ali. He is the Pioneers Chair in Telecommunications and Professor of Telecommunications in the Belisario College at Penn State. He also researches broadband access and democracy. So looking forward to hearing from them.
Really, really important conversation coming up. Desma Kosma and Christopher Ali. Really great to have both of you here on Created Equal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, Desa, I want to start with you. And again, my astonishment at the things you found with this audit of 261 polling locations across 15 places here in Southeast Michigan. I just want to repeat that before we get to the conversation. 84% of the polling locations were not compliant. They were not accessible. I want to start with you just telling us about the kinds of things you found in these locations that make them inaccessible to everyone.
Well, thanks for having me, Stephen. It's really good to be here. We were actually looking at four main categories in our 2022 audit, and we're doing it again in this election cycle. We started with a February presidential primary. I did it again in August, and we'll do it more in November. And these four categories are based on federal and state laws, requirements that poll places are accessible in particular ways. So none of the things that we evaluated at polling sites are mere convenience or nice to have. They're absolutely essential to equitable access to our democracy, and they're actually written into law. So the four main categories that we evaluated were an accessible parking area with a clear accessible pathway into the building. That's the first one. Mm-hmm. The second one is an accessible entrance. Is the door wide enough for a wheelchair, for example, to get in? Is there a push button, or is the door light enough to open with one hand? Those are two ways that a door can be accessible or not. The third category is whether or not there is a fully accessible voter assist terminal, which is what we call an accessible voting machine in Michigan. We often refer to it as a VAT, a voter assist terminal. It's the machine that someone can use to fill out a ballot, have it printed out, and then put into the tabulator if they're not able to fill out a pen and paper ballot. These are really important machines for people with physical disabilities, people who are blind, or people with learning or cognitive disabilities. And then finally, a poll site is required to have an accessible booth for casting a paper ballot privately. So that means someone like me, who is a wheelchair user, can not only park my car and safely get out, not into oncoming traffic, roll into the building, get in the door, get my ballot, and then choose between the voter assist terminal, where I can vote on the machine, or roll up to a desk that's the appropriate height for a seated person and vote privately by hand. So these are the four categories that we evaluated. And in the intro, you're absolutely right. 84% that don't meet these four requirements is outrageous, and it's really unacceptable.
Yeah. Yeah. Give us a sense of the physical, I guess, condition of these places. How many are out of compliance with just one of these criteria? How many are out of compliance with three or four? I guess I'm trying to get a sense of how far we are from being able to say that this works the way it should.
Right. Very good questions. And currently, we are pretty far from where we need to be. Hmm. But there's really good news embedded in all of the bad news. So to your first question, 26% of all of the polling sites that we evaluated in 2022 scored no on only one of the four categories I just talked about.
Okay.
Meaning that if that one thing at that 26% of locations was fixed, we would actually have an accessibility rate of 42% across the region, which is, a lot better than 16%,
yes.
But it's still insufficient.
It's still a minority of voters, right? Yeah.
It's really, it shows what a long way to go we have. However, while some of these barriers that we're talking about, I'm happy to dig into this, are about the built environment and about basically aging and crumbling infrastructure that I think all Detroiters are aware of, not just disabled Detroiters, although it does impact us more intensely. The good news is, besides that, the kind of problems that we noted in our evaluation are often game day decisions, meaning that they could have been set up a different way that was accessible.
I see.
But the person setting it up didn't stop and think about it or didn't receive the proper training to do it the right way. And so those are things that don't cost money to fix or cost very little money to fix and can be done easily if we actually just have the intention to do so.
Yeah. When we think of the kinds of these kinds of barriers and what they represent to people who encounter them, I think the most frightening or harrowing scenario is somebody shows up to vote on election day and they just they're unable to do it because the polling place is not accessible to them. Obviously, that's not the only potential outcome. I suppose, people could get help to vote. There could be some accommodations made. But I want to get a sense of how frequently people are essentially just being turned away from this fundamental right because of accessibility. Do you have a sense of how many people are just not able to vote because of these things?
We do. We have some national data on that. And we have a lot of local experiences, myself included, that really show what happens like in real time and how it feels to be that voter, which I also think is super important because disabled people in general in this country as a group are not doing well. Like we score very low on most quality of life indices around, you know, wealth and education and health and length of life. And yet none of that is inevitable. It all has to do with ableism and not having policies and practices in place that allow us to fully engage in our communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to participate in the democratic process is super important to us because we have everything to gain from more political influence and more representation in government. And I can tell you as a disabled voter, it is frustrating and demoralizing and dehumanizing to go exercise my right to vote and realize that people weren't prepared for me to show up. When they were thinking about who mattered and who they needed to set up the day for, I wasn't on their list. And that's why my organization exists. That's why Detroit Disability Power organizes disabled people and our allies to change that attitude, to educate the public, and to change the policies that are holding us back.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have an answer to your question locally in terms of how many disabled voters are essentially being turned away from the process. But we do know nationally that if disabled people voted at the same rate as non-disabled peers, there would be 1.75 million more voters as part of the electorate.
Wow.
And if you think about how closely elections are won in this country, that's really significant.
It's a lot of people.
And it's a lot of people. And frankly, we are this incredibly large, mostly untapped constituency of people with a lot of common needs and common demands. And so, you know, in my view, I think in candidate, it should be in candidates' view, we are folks you want to be courting to turn out and vote.
Mm-hmm.
And if a candidate is doing that and then we show up and we can't get in the building, we have, you know, a lot of problems. So that's some national data. There's additional national data that Rutgers collects that shows that 1 in 7 disabled voters report challenges voting, which is more than twice that of non-disabled voters. So this really is an equity issue.
Yeah, yeah. Tessa, you mentioned that you have maybe experienced this problem. I wonder if you can talk about the experiences you've had trying to get access to voting places.
I can. I have two really frustrating experiences in the last 10 years. Back in 2018, I had recently moved, and so I had a new precinct, and I was really pleased when I got there that there was accessible parking. I was able to get my wheelchair out. I was able to roll into the building. I got my ballot from the nice poll workers at the table, and then I turned around to go vote, and there was nowhere that wasn't a standing height voting booth. So I would have had to fill out my ballot above my head, which I cannot do. And so I turned back to the poll worker and I said, oh, you know, where should I vote? and she looked a little confused. She moved some papers aside from where she was sitting and said, you can vote right here. And I said, well, that's very nice of you, but I'm also entitled to private voting.
Mm-hmm.
She got a little grumpy with me, didn't totally know what to do, but thankfully another poll worker overheard the conversation and cleared off a table across the room where I could vote at the right height and in a private manner. So I was able to fill out my ballot. But as I left that day, I, again, was shaken by this sense that they didn't think that anybody in a wheelchair was going to come vote. Like, there are 129,000 disabled residents in the city of Detroit alone,
mm-hmm.
and nobody had thought that somebody like me in a wheelchair was going to show up and exercise our right to vote. And so that's just extremely disturbing. And later that night, I had an advisory board meeting for my organization, and I was, you know, in a mood after that experience.
<I'll bet. laughs>
And I shared it with the advisory board, who for the most part were other disabled Detroiters of a whole wide variety of disabilities represented in this group. And, you know, every one of them said, Dessa, I had a similar experience. Mm. When I went to vote, I couldn't do it easily, or I wasn't able to do it. And this is what happened. And I thought, okay, well, this needs to be a major focus of the work of Detroit Disability Power, because this is not just a Dessa problem. This is a systemic problem. And it seems absolutely solvable with some education and some intentionality and some advocacy. So that was 2018. That is actually what launched the collaborative poll access audit that we've been talking about.
Okay.
Fast forward to 2020, I thought, okay, let me use the voter assist terminal, which is designed for disabled voters, but can be used by anyone. You don't have to be disabled to use it. And even though I can fill out a paper ballot, I thought, let me use the voter assist terminal so I can educate myself uh-huh. about how it feels to use it. And I can also see if the poll worker is on their game. They were not, unfortunately. Mm. And it took them 45 minutes to figure out how to turn on the machine and get me to my ballot. I fortunately have a flexible job where I could stick around and make sure that I cast my vote. But many people wouldn't be able to do that. And so it just reiterated again that people were not prepared for people with disabilities to show up and vote.
Yeah. So it's really interesting to hear both of those in both of those stories that this was about preparation. This was about the anticipation of the poll workers and, of course, the clerks who are responsible for making sure that elections go off without a hitch. Again, your point about the anticipation that someone who has physical challenges will show up to vote. They just didn't account for that. In your estimation, is that the sort of meat of this problem, not actual physical barrier so much as it's almost like a mental block that that elections officials have?
It's really both, Stephen. You know, the way that ableism, which is the systemic oppression of people with disabilities,
mm-hmm.
the way that ableism shows up is that it shows up in so many ways, but it shows up in that it invisibilizes us. So even though we're at least 25% of the population, we're not thought about all that much. We're not prioritized all that much.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of out of sight, out of mind a lot, which is extremely detrimental to our well-being and doesn't realistically reflect the real diversity of our communities if you're excluding 25% of people from being their full selves and showing up in that fullness. So there's that kind of underlying systemic problem that absolutely influences whether or not we're thought about by clerks and poll workers to the extent that we need to be. There's also, you know, other issues around aging infrastructure and the way that cities like Detroit have been disinvested in.
Mm-hmm.
The ways that we have so many problems around race and class and access to functional infrastructure. So it is about intentionality, and it is about disability, and it is about the built environment, but it's also a much bigger picture that all connects. So, you know, like I said, many of the problems we see at precincts are game day decisions. They're things like having an accessible entrance that then is propped open with a giant barrel that therefore makes it inaccessible, right? Like, that's a solvable problem.
Sure.
But if you're the person trying to get in the door and there's no one there to move the barrel, what do you do?
Hmm.
We heard this election in August, we got a call about a person in a wheelchair that showed up to vote at a church on the west side and had to crawl up 5 stairs to get in the building cast their ballot.
Wow.
That's unacceptable. That's not only humiliating, but that's dangerous.
Yes.
But that person cared so much about participating in democracy that they did that. These are people that should be, that is an awesome voter, but they should have never had to do that. But that's a person that should have been prioritized.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to continue this conversation about voter access and physical voter access here in Southeast Michigan and around the country. We're going to keep Dessa Cosma of the Detroit Disability Power and Christopher Ali, a professor of telecommunications at Penn State. We're going to talk in the next segment about internet access and connectivity and how that plays a role in barriers to voter access. We also want to get going with you, the listeners, on the phones. We're going to take calls in the last segment of the show today, but we can get them queued up now. Give us a call and let us know what your experiences are with voter access here in Southeast Michigan. Have you shown up at a polling place and not been able to get in or get around or access your ballot in the way that you need to because they didn't anticipate someone with the challenges that you may have? Give us a sense of what your experiences have been. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter, hashtag created equal, or at WDET. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and today we're talking about voter accessibility, literal voter accessibility. How easy is it for someone with physical challenges to show up at a polling place and cast a ballot right alongside people who don't have those challenges? Detroit Disability Power is a nonprofit that has taken a look at the problems that we have here in Southeast Michigan with accessibility. They polled 261 different locations across Southeast Michigan and found that 84% of them were not compliant in a way that would make sure that everyone could access them to vote. We're talking about how we correct those challenges and, of course, what those challenges mean to people who are trying to cast their ballots. Dessa Cosma is with us. She's the executive director of Detroit Disability Power. We've also got Christopher Ali with us, and he's a professor of telecommunications at Penn State. He's the author of Farm Fresh Broadband, Politics of Rural Connectivity. We're also talking about the challenges that the digital divide presents now to voter access, given how much of our lives and, of course, of our democratic participation takes place on the internet. We want to hear from you as well. Give us a call and let us know about your experiences trying to cast ballots here in Southeast Michigan. Are you someone who's experienced physical barriers to being able to cast your ballot? Have you had to do something extraordinary to get into a polling place or to access your ballot? Are you someone who has been turned away from casting a ballot because of those challenges? 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Created Equal or at WDET. Christopher Ali, I want to start this part of the show talking with you about the digital divide and the barriers that it presents to voting. Let's start here. Why is the internet an essential part of democratic participation right now?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a great place to start. The internet is our window to the world right now, right? It is how we get news and information. It is how we connect with friends and family. It is how we do work. It is how we engage with many of the services, governmental services included, that we need to do on our daily basis. It's how we apply for or how we booked a COVID vaccine and how often we apply for benefits and file our taxes. It is the gateway to so much of what we do in our day-to-day lives, which is why it is essential that everyone in the United States have access to affordable, meaningful, high-speed internet.
And what kinds of things do we define as this kind of digital access? Is it as simple as having access to the internet? I mean, lots of people have phones that have some form of internet access, and then, of course, others have broadband connectivity in their home. Talk about what we're concerned with here, or the focal point of this access from a democratic standpoint.
Sure thing. So I like to think about this in terms of pillars, right? You've got, can I access a physical internet network, right? Mm-hmm. Do I have access to the internet? Mm-hmm. Can I afford access to the internet? Here in the United States, we pay more per month than anywhere else in the 38 countries that make up the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. So we pay an astronomical amount for broadband, and we know that 50 million American households and families either can't afford the internet or struggle to afford the internet because of the high costs. So we've got access, we've got affordability, and then we've also got skills and devices. Do I have the skills necessary to take advantage of my digital connectivity? Do I have a computer at home? And you'd mentioned, yes, there's a lot of folks who have access to a smartphone. In fact, over 85% of the population have access to a smartphone. That's great, but a smartphone isn't going to replace a home internet connection. And here's a great example. I'm a professor at Penn State. Imagine if I asked my students to write an essay on their smartphone, mm-hmm. right? That's going to be next to impossible. Imagine if I asked you to file your taxes on your smartphone, right? There are certain things that we can do with a smartphone. Smartphones are amazing. But to get that full digital experience, we need broadband to the home, probably with a computer or at least something more capable than a smartphone. So we've got all of these pillars. And otherwise, you know, the internet is just kind of wires in the ground unless we can afford it and we know how to use it and we have the devices and support to be able to take advantage of it. And tens of millions of American families don't fit with all three of these criteria.
Right, right. So how does that connect to the democratic participation we're talking about, the access to voting? What are the things that you are cut off from, I suppose, in that realm if you don't have sufficient internet access?
Sure. So one of the major things that you're cut off from is news and information. I did a study with a couple of colleagues in the organization Rebuild Local News, and we found that there are 90 counties in the United States that are what we call double deserts, counties without access to the internet and counties without a local news outlet. So in other words, these are 90 counties where you can't get access to fresh, up-to-date local news and information, or at least you got to work really hard to do it. 90 such counties. How are we supposed to make meaningful voting happen if we don't have access to local news and information? So, you know, that's number one. Studies have also shown that if you have a high-speed internet connection at your home, you're probably more likely to engage with a local elected official. You know, if we say that all politics are local and democracy begins at the local level, right, it begins with this type of communication with our neighbors, communication with our elected officials, and then receiving and partaking in the news and information ecosystem. So many are barred from these essential democratic functions of to be an informed voter, to exercise our basic democratic rights, to be informed and then to vote. And without access to the internet, it makes it that much harder to do it.
Yeah. So when we talk about the digital divide, of course, I mean, that's something that affects a lot of different parts of our culture and people's participation in a number of different things. Talk about how important this is, how much impact there is from a democratic standpoint, from the digital divide. How many people are really challenged by this, and it affects the way, or I guess the efficiency with which they're able to cast ballots?
Sure. So we know that somewhere between 24 million and 42 million Americans do not have access to a broadband network. As in, they can't, even if they wanted to subscribe to the internet, they have no network in their home or their apartment that they can subscribe to.
Wow.
And that's particularly an egregious case in rural communities and on tribal land. But it doesn't mean that urban folks are also struggling. You know, there's a huge chunk of New York City that doesn't have access to the internet, for instance. So it you know, it's worse off in rural and tribal areas, but it certainly exists in urban areas as well. We also know that at least 50 million households struggle to pay for their internet subscription. And we know this because we used to have a program, the federal government used to have a program called the Affordable Connectivity Program. And that was a subsidy for broadband subscriptions for eligible households, and how you could be eligible, a household, for instance, if you had a kid who participated in a free or reduced lunch program at school, right? That made your whole household eligible. Mm-hmm. And that was $30 a month, or $75 a month if you lived on tribal land. 50 million households were eligible for that program, and at the end, about 23 million actually subscribed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we know that at least 50 million households are struggling to afford their internet subscription or just can't at all. And I've heard from folks who have told me, you know, in surveys that I've had access to, hey, I'm debating if I can afford food or my internet right now.
Wow.
Right? That is awful. And then what we don't really have a collective number on is the tens of millions of folks who don't have the confidence, the digital confidence, to really take advantage of their internet connections, right? They may not have the skills. They may not have the devices. They may not have the support to be able to do this. And again, if you don't know how to use your computer, it's just a brick.
Yeah.
it's a brick sucking up electricity.
Right.
And so we've got these three. What I can tell you is that the National Digital Skills Coalition found that 92% of jobs will require digital training in some capacity. And so this goes back to ideas of digital confidence, digital literacy. There's a great term that Professor Sharon Strover uses at the University of Texas called digital dignity. And I love these ideas because it's helping folks achieve whatever it is that they want to achieve. Mm-hmm. And voting, of course, and being an informed voter is one of those essential pillars.
Yeah. So Christopher, what do we do about this? I mean, as I said in the open, I feel like in some ways the digital divide is getting a little worse. I mean, technology is moving really fast forward, and there are lots of things that are kind of developing. And it feels like the people who are left behind are being left further behind every time something else develops that makes it easier for those who do have internet connectivity. So what, I guess, makes you optimistic or gives you hope about the idea that we can bridge this divide and get more people to be able to participate?
Absolutely. So I think one of the first things to understand about the digital divide is that it's actually less about technology access and broadband access than it is about power and inequality.
Hmm.
I mean, the communities that are most likely to be marginalized in this country, low-income communities, BIPOC communities, justice-impacted individuals, newcomers to the country, non-English language speakers, all of these communities that are more likely to be marginalized in any other capacity are more likely to be on the wrong side of these digital divides, right? So the digital divide truly confronted also means confronting the amount of structural inequality that exists in this country. That's point one. So it's a much larger, sort of a much larger conversation. But to get to the, you know, to drill down to the things that are making me optimistic are what I'm seeing happening in communities across the country. I really do think that the way forward, the way through these digital divides is going to happen at the local community level. I mean, librarians are the heroes of digital literacy, right? They're the ones day in and day out working with folks on how to use a computer, how to build a resume, right? How to surf the internet safely. Shout out to every single librarian. I was in the city of Pittsburgh a few weeks ago, and the housing authority there, thanks to some foundation giving, created what they call a cyber bus that drives around to low-income neighborhoods and offers a very powerful hotspot in addition to computer training, which is just an amazing use of community resources. Mm-hmm. In Virginia, Albemarle County, Virginia, has recognized how important affordable broadband is, and so they've allocated county funds to offsetting broadband subscriptions for low-income households. So all of this is happening at the local level, and this is what I love to see, because this is really, I think, going back to the whole point of our conversation about where democracy begins. Mm-hmm. It begins at the community and local level, and this is that stuff that I love to see. At the federal level, we are about to see the largest investment in telecommunications in the country's history rollout. It's a $42 billion program called the BEAD program, the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program. And that's going to go to hopefully bringing fiber optic connectivity to folks across the country. And then we've got another $2.75 billion dedicated to what's called digital equity and inclusion. And that goes to things like workforce development and education and digital skills and digital confidence. So there's some big money coming down the pipes in the next few years, which hopefully these communities are going to be able to take advantage of.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, Christopher Ali, I know that you have to run. I really do appreciate you being here with us on Created Equal and updating us on the challenges presented by the digital divide. Christopher, thanks so much for being with us on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
We're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about barriers to voter access. We're going to keep Dessa Cosma, who's the executive director of Detroit Disability Power. We're also going to get to you, the listeners, on the phones and on social. Give us a call. Let us know what your experiences have been like trying to vote in Southeast Michigan. Have you experienced physical barriers to polling places? Have you had experiences that maybe turned you away from being able to vote? 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter, hashtag Created Equal, or at WDET. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and we're talking about voter accessibility, literal voter accessibility, instances where polling places and poll workers aren't prepared for people with physical challenges to be able to cast their ballots. We were also in the last segment talking about internet connectivity and how that can present challenges to people voting as well. We want to hear from you during the conversation. Give us a call. 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Tell us about your experience voting here in Southeast Michigan, the times that maybe you've experienced barriers to being able to fully participate in our democracy. We've got Dessa Cosma here. She's the executive director of Detroit Disability Power. They did a survey of 261 polling locations in Southeast Michigan and found 84% of them were not compliant. We would love to hear from you about your experiences voting here in Southeast Michigan. Let's start this segment going to the phones. Gay in Highland Park, you're up first. Gay, what's on your mind?
Hello. I wanted to mention what happened in Highland Park. Mm-hmm. Over time. Mm-hmm. When I first started voting in Highland Park, voting place was down a long concrete steps to the basement. Mm. And there wasn't even a railing. But once I maneuvered down there, then there was no place really to vote that you could sit down or use a wheelchair, anything like that. Couldn't get there with a wheelchair. Then they changed the whole thing. They put it on the first floor and put a ramp into the building and made it totally accessible with a place that people could sit down at a wheelchair level, and it's changed completely. And that's what every place needs to do. Of course, I'm using absentee balloting now. But there's another issue to bring up, and that is the stigma attached in families to keeping family members hidden. It's been true all over the world in many, many countries, and it still exists all over the place.
So, Gay, can you talk just a little bit more about what you mean by that, keeping family members hidden?
Well, there's a shame, a stigma. There's a shame to having somebody who is crippled in a family. And that's true in China and a lot of other places. They keep the family members who are disabled or crippled or even have dementia. They keep them hidden. And my own grandmother, she was from Germany, and she was deeply ashamed that there was a crippled child in the house. And she took it out on me until my father put his foot down. But it was a deep shame. And it's something that does happen all over the world.
Yeah, yeah. Gay, you talked about the positive change that happened in Highland Park with the polling site. I wonder if you could talk about how that happened. Did you speak up about it? Did others speak up about it and get them to change it? Or did they just
spoke up about it? I never really talked to anybody who did speak up about it. But it seemed to be an awareness that came in from the clerk's office and everything. And I think during the Blackwell administration at some point
Blackwell.
There.
Yeah, sure.
It could have been.
Yeah. Gay, I really appreciate you calling and sharing that experience with us. That's a good story about them changing the accessibility in Highland Park to make sure that more people can access it. But I'm also somewhat saddened by your story about the shame that you have experienced inside your own family because of your physical challenges. Dessa Cosmo, I'll give you a chance to react to what Gay's talking about here.
Well, I'm certainly glad that Highland Park improved the accessibility of the polling location. And I have no doubt that it was because of local advocates. And, you know, what Gay is saying about the stigma attached to disability is a very real problem that our community faces. It is part of ableism that we are considered less than our non-disabled peers, which is, of course, absolutely not true. We are different than non-disabled people in certain ways, but by and large, we have many similarities with non-disabled people and certainly deserve equal rights and equal access to everything that our communities have to offer. And it is through organizing and activism and building power that the disability community has made the strides that we have over recent decades. It's the disability rights and justice movement that pressured Congress to pass the Americans with Disabilities Act, for example, and many other protections that we've been able to get, including the protections that we have to vote, like the Help America Vote Act or the Civil Rights Act. And that organizing and activism is what we're continuing to do through these poll access audits. You know, we did audits for several election cycles in a volunteer capacity, asking our members to check out their polling site when they went to vote and then give us feedback that we could then share with clerks. And we shared this kind of non-scientific data and the anecdotes that came with it, and we made some progress. But in 2022, we had the opportunity to work with the Carter Center, which does international election observation. It's highly regarded in that field. They worked with us to come up with a very sophisticated methodology to go evaluate these polls and to do it at scale. That's how we were able to do 261 in one day between the polls opening at 7 and them closing at 8 p.m. And we knew that we needed that kind of data to show up to people in positions of power to get them to actually pay more attention. We needed something stamped with the Carter Center's name and tables of granular data to make the point that we had been making for a long time. And so our community is fighting really hard to have a seat at the table, and we need allies to help us do that. The stigma And shame around disability is still real, but it's waning. Mm-hmm. We are going into a new era where people can begin to understand disability not as a deficit, and maybe not even simply as a difference, but as a value-added part of a person's human diversity,
right,
and a part of what we can offer our communities. Because when we're stuffed away, as Gay was saying, and shut in our homes because people are ashamed of us or because the world doesn't accommodate us, when we're stuffed away, it's not only us that are suffering, it's the entire community that's sure. suffering from our absence.
Yep.
And that is a really important thing to remember.
Yeah, yeah. I also wonder what the reactions have been to this audit that you performed of these 261 polling places. You find that 84% of them are not compliant. Are communities saying, okay, we'll fix that? You continue to do audits. Are you seeing that they're actually fixing it and that the numbers is going down?
So as soon as we did the audit in the November election of 2022, we spent the next few months analyzing the data and writing a comprehensive report, which we released then following spring. And as soon as we released the report, which can be found in full on our website at DetroitDisabilityPower.org, we held a briefing for the local clerks from the 15 municipalities that we audited. And I just want to pause for one moment and say the problem that we found, this 84% of inaccessible polling sites, this is not a Detroit or a Michigan-only problem. This is a national problem. Mm-hmm. There was one other large study done in 2016 of 178 polling sites across the United States. It was done by the Government Accountability Office. And they found that only 17% of sites were accessible.
Wow.
So here in Detroit, it's 16%. Nationally, the data shows 17%, which shows that this is a much bigger problem than any one clerk or one state doing something poorly. It's really a systemic issue. So we held a briefing to share the report and the findings, and we engaged clerks because what we're trying to do is solve the problem. We're not trying to just call out clerks. We're trying to get them to do better. And so that's education. That's sometimes pushing them because they're elected officials and they have constituents. And some clerks have been very receptive and other clerks have completely ignored us. But that doesn't change the fact that we're going to keep doing the audits and we're going to keep publishing the data. And we're going to keep organizing until all of our polling locations are accessible.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Dessa Cosma, Executive Director of Detroit Disability Power. It was really great to have you here with us during this conversation today about voter accessibility. Thanks so much for joining us on Created Equal.
Thank you for having me. Mm-hmm.
So, Carrie,
mm-hmm.
really, I think harrowing stories, and
yeah.
There's an enraging factor to this discussion, I think,
yeah.
about the ways in which people are discounted and not treated as equal.
Yeah, it also makes me think about, when she was talking about the access to the polling locations, right, and the stigma that's attached to it. That's something I think a lot of people can understand to some degree when you have something that kind of makes you different, the initial perception and then the fact that they aren't taken into account when it comes to like the broader regulations these buildings have. Mm-hmm. You would think that where polling locations typically are, there would be these types of accommodations, but that's not the case.
Yeah, it's not.
And I'm glad that DESA is going to continue to press on for these issues too going forward.
So. Yeah, they plan to poll voting places this November. They did it in the primary. I mean, they're really trying to keep track of it,
right,
which I think helps to put pressure on communities to try to clear it up. It's also, I think, really important to note that in so many cases, and including her own personal experiences, this is just about people paying attention,
right,
and making sure that they're doing the right things. It's not about changing the physical nature of some places. It really is just about saying, hey, we need to make sure that this polling place is available to everybody who wants to cast a ballot.
Right. And then the process in which they can vote is also pretty accessible for them as well. She talked mm-hmm. about height and all that
yep.
stuff. So,
yeah. Okay, that is going to do it for us on Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes of the show at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lyons. Our engineer is Nate Bender. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.